Side 9. Domes of Fire. The Tomilly, Book 1. By David Eddings. Continuing on page 323.
That was an interesting exchange, wasn't it? Sparhawk murmured to Sophronia.
Yes, the small woman agreed. Has she been letting things slip that way very often?
I didn't quite follow that.
She's not really supposed to talk about symbols the way she just did. Not when she's around pagans.
I wish you wouldn't use that word to describe us, Sophronia.
Well, aren't you?
It sort of depends on your perspective. What's so important about symbols that she's supposed to hide them?
It's not the symbols themselves, Sparhawk. It's what talking about them that way reveals.
Oh? What's that?
The fact that she doesn't look at the world or think about it in the same way we do. There are meanings in the world for her that we can't even begin to comprehend.
I'll take your word for it. Are you and Mirtai sisters now, too? I mean, if she's Danny's sister, and so are you, wouldn't you almost have to be?
All women are sisters, Sparhawk.
That's a generalization, Sophronia.
How perceptive of you to have noticed.
Vanyan entered the room.
Where's Aelana? He asked.
She and Betwana are conferring, Sparhawk replied.
Who's translating for them?
One of Engessa's girls from Darsus.
What did you want to talk with her about? I think we'll be leaving tomorrow. Engessa Oscania and I talked with King Andril. Oscania feels that we should press on to Mathurian. He doesn't want to keep the Emperor waiting. Engessa's sending his legions back to Darsus. He'll be going on with us, largely because he speaks Hellenic better than most Aetons.
That doesn't disappoint me, Mirtai said. He's my father now, and we really ought to get to know each other better.
You're enjoying this, aren't you, Vanyan? Sophronia said it half accusingly.
I've missed it, he admitted. I've been at the center of things for most of my life. I don't think I was meant to sit on the back shelf.
Weren't you happy when there were just the two of us?
Of course I was. I'd have been perfectly content to spend the rest of my life alone with you. But we're not alone anymore. The world's intruding upon us, Sophronia, and we both have responsibilities. We still have time for each other, though.
Are you sure, Vanyan?
I'll make sure, love.
Would you two like to be alone?
Mirtai asked them with an arch little smile.
Later, perhaps,
Sophronia replied quite calmly.
Won't we be a little undermanned without Engessa's Aetons? Sparhawk asked. King Andril's making arrangements, Vanyan said. Don't worry, Sparhawk. Your wife's almost as important to the rest of us as she is to you. We're not going to let anything happen to her.
We can discount the possibility of exaggeration, Sophronia said. The Aeton character makes that very unlikely.
I'll agree there, Sparhawk concurred. They're warriors, and they're trained to give precise reports.
Vanyan and Zelasta nodded. It was evening, and the four of them were walking together outside the city in order to discuss the situation apart from Norcan and Oscania. It was not that they distrusted the two Tamils. It was just that they wanted to be able to speak freely about certain things the Tamils were culturally unprepared to accept.
Our opponent is quite obviously a god, Zelasta said firmly. He says it so casually, Vanyan noted. Are you so accustomed to confronting gods that you're becoming blasé about it, Zelasta?
Zelasta smiled.
Just defining the problem, Lord Vanyan. The resurrection of whole armies is beyond purely human capabilities. You can take my word for that. I tried it once and made a horrible mess of it. It took me weeks to get them all back into the ground again. We've faced gods before, Vanyan shrugged. We stared across a border at Azash for 500 years.
Now who's blasé? Sophronia said.
Just defining the solution, love, he replied. The church knights were founded for just such situations. We really need to identify our enemy, though. Gods have worshippers, and our enemy's inevitably utilizing his worshippers in this plan. We have to find out who he is, so that we know who his adherents are. We can't disrupt his plans until we know whom to attack. Am I being obvious?
Yes, Sparhawk told him. But logic always is right at first. I like the notion of attacking his worshippers.
If we do that, he's going to have to stop what he's doing and concentrate on protecting his own people. The strength of a god depends entirely on his worshippers. If we start killing his people, we'll diminish him with every sword stroke.
Barbarian,
Sifrini accused. Can you make her stop doing that to me, Vanyan? Sparhawk appealed. She's called me both a pagan and a barbarian so far today.
Well, aren't you?
She said. Maybe, but it's not nice to come right out and say it like that. It's the presence of the trolls that has concerned me since you told me about it at Sarsos, Zelasta told them. They are not drawn from the past, and they have but recently come to this part of the world from their ancestral home in Thalesia. I know little of trolls, but it was my understanding that they are fiercely attached to their homeland. What could have provoked this migration? Ulath's baffled, Sparhawk replied. I gather that the Thalesians are so happy that the trolls have left that they didn't pursue the matter.
Trolls don't habitually cooperate with each other, Sifrinia told them. One of them might have decided on his own to leave Thalesia, but he'd have never persuaded the rest to go with him.
You're raising a very unpleasant possibility, love, Vanyan said. They all looked at each other. Is there any way they could have gotten out of Belium? Vanyan asked Sifrinia.
I don't know, Vanyan. Sparhawk asked me the same question quite some time ago. I don't know what spell Gwerig used to seal them inside the jewel. Troll spells aren't the same as ours.
Then we don't know if they're still inside, or if they've somehow managed to free themselves? She nodded glumly. The fact that the trolls banded up and left their ancestral home all at the same time suggests that something with sufficient authority over them commanded them to leave, Zelasta mused. That would be their gods, all right. Vanyan's face was as glum as Sifrinia's. Trolls wouldn't obey anyone else. He sighed. Well, we wanted to know who was opposing us. I think we may have just found out. You're all full of light and joy today, Vanyan, Sparhawk said sourly. But I'd like something a little more concrete before I declare war on the trolls. How did you force the troll gods to stop attacking you in Zemok, Prince Sparhawk? Zelasta asked him. I used the Belium. It rather looks as if you'll have to use it again. I don't suppose you happened to bring it with you, did you? Sparhawk looked quickly at Sifrinia. You didn't tell him? He asked with a certain surprise.
It wasn't necessary for him to know, dear one. Dolmont wanted us all to keep it more or less to ourselves, remember?
I gather that it's not with you then, Prince Sparhawk, Zelasta surmised. Did you leave it in some safe place in Samura? It's in a safe place, all right, learned one, Sparhawk replied bleakly. But it's not in Samura. Where is it, then? After we used it to destroy Azash, we threw it into the sea. Zelasta's face went chalk white.
In the deepest part of the deepest ocean in the world, Sifrinia added.
Chapter 21
It is along the north coast, Aelana Queen, Norcan translated Queen Betwana's reply. These shaggy ones you call trolls have come across the winter ice in large groups for the past 2 years. At first our people thought they were bears, but it was not so. They avoided us at first, and the snow and fog of winter made it hard for our people to see them clearly. When there were more of them here, they grew bolder. It was not until one of them was killed that we realized they were not bears. King Andril was not present. Andril's intellectual gifts were not profound, and he much preferred to let his wife deal with state matters. The Aton King looked very impressive, but he was at his best in ceremonial situations, where no surprises were likely to come up. Ask her if they've seen any trolls farther south, Sparhawk murmured to his wife.
Why don't you ask her?
Let's keep things sort of formal, Aelana. This is technically a conversation between the two of you. I don't think the rest of us are supposed to join in. Let's not take a chance of violating a propriety we don't know about.
Aelana posed the question, and Oscania translated.
No,
Norcan repeated Betwana's answer. The trolls appear to have settled in the forests along the north slopes. So far as we know, they haven't come deeper into Aton. Warn her that trolls are very good at hiding in forests, Olaf advised.
So are we, the reply was translated.
Ask her if some advice on tactics would offend her, the Genidian knight said then. We Thalesians have had many experiences with trolls, most of them bad.
We are always willing to listen to the voice of experience, came the Aton Queen's reply.
When we encounter trolls in Thalesia, we usually stay back a ways and shoot some arrows into them, Olaf informed Elana. It's hard to kill them with arrows, because their fur and their hides are so thick, but it's a good idea to slow them down if you can. Trolls are much, much quicker than they look, and they have very long arms. They can snatch a man out of his saddle quicker than the man can blink.
Elana went through the formality of repeating his words.
What does the troll do then?
Betwana's expression was curious.
First he pulls off the man's head. Then he eats the rest of him. Trolls don't like to eat heads for some reason.
Elana choked slightly on that.
We do not use the bow in war,
Norcan translated Betwana's flowing Tamil.
We only use it in the hunt for creatures we intend to eat. Well, Olaf said a bit dubiously, you could eat a troll if you wanted to, I guess. I won't guarantee the flavor, though.
I refuse to repeat that, Sir Olaf, Elana exclaimed.
Ask her if javelins would be acceptable in the Aton culture, Tinian suggested.
Javelins would be quite all right, Norcan replied. I've seen the Aetons practicing with them. Betwana spoke to him rapidly and at some length.
Her Majesty's asked me to translate a narrative, Norcan told them. The sun is well up, and she knows you should be on the road. Oskanya tells me that you're planning to take the road leading to Libas in Tamil proper. Aeton societies organized along clan lines, and each clan has its own territory. You'll be passed along from clan to clan as you ride east. It's a breach of etiquette for one clan to intrude on the territory of another, and breaches of etiquette are avoided at all costs here in Aeton.
I wonder why, Stragan murmured.
Oskanya, Norcan said then, as soon as you reach civilization, send me a score or so of imperial messengers with fast horses. Her Majesty wants to keep in close contact with Matherian during the crisis.
Very good idea, Oskanya agreed.
Then Betwana rose, towering over all of them. She affectionately embraced Elana and then Mirtai, clearly indicating that it was time for them to continue their journey eastward.
I will cherish the memory of this visit, dear Betwana, Elana told her. And I will as well, dearly loved sister queen,
Betwana replied in almost flawless Alenic.
Elana smiled. I wondered how long you were going to hide your understanding of our language, Betwana, she said.
You knew?
Betwana seemed surprised.
Elana nodded. It's very hard to keep your face and your eyes from revealing your understanding while you're waiting for the translation. Why do you keep your knowledge of Alenic a secret?
The time the translator takes to convert your words into human speech gives me time to consider my reply.
Betwana shrugged.
That's a very useful tactic, Elana said admiringly. I wish I could use it in Eosia, but everybody there speaks Alenic, so I couldn't really get away with it.
Bandage your ears, Olaf suggested.
Does he have to do that?
Elana complained to Sparhawk.
It's only a suggestion, Your Majesty.
Olaf shrugged.
Pretend to be deaf and have some people around to wiggle their fingers at you as if they were translating.
She stared at him. That's absurd, Olaf. Do you have any idea how awkward and inconvenient that would be?
I just said it was a suggestion, Your Majesty, he said mildly. I didn't say it was a good one.
Following a formal farewell that was once again primarily for Mirtai's benefit, the queen and her party rode eastward out of Aetana along the Libas Road. Once they were clear of the city, Oskanya, who had insisted on riding a horse that day, suggested to Sparhawk, Stragan, and Vanyan that they ride forward to confer with the other knights. They found them near the head of the column. Tinian was entertaining them with a much embellished account of a probably imaginary amorous adventure.
"What's afoot?" Carlton asked when Sparhawk and the others joined them.
"Sparhawk and I conferred with Sephrenia and Zelasta last night," Vanyan replied. "We thought we might share the fruits of our discussions, out of Aelana's hearing."
"That sounds ominous," the blonde Pandion observed.
"Not entirely," Vanyan smiled. "Our conclusions are still a bit tenuous, and there's no point in alarming the Queen until we're a bit more certain."
"Then there is something to be alarmed about, isn't there, Lord Vanyan?" Talon asked.
"There's always something to be alarmed about," Khalad told his brother. "We've sort of concluded that we're facing a god," Vanyan told them. "I'm sure you've all more or less worked that out for yourselves."
"Did you really have to invite me to come along this time, Sparhawk?"
Carlton complained.
"I'm not very good at dealing with gods."
"Who is?" "You weren't so bad at Zemok."
"Luck, probably." "This is sort of the way our reasoning went," Vanyan continued. "You've been seeing that shadow again, and the cloud. On the surface, at least, they seem to be divine manifestations. And these armies out of the past, the Lamorks and the Seergai, couldn't have been raised by a mortal. Zelasta told us that he'd tried it once, and that it all fell apart on him. If he can't do it, we can be fairly sure that nobody else can either."
"Logical,"
Bevier approved.
"Thank you. Now then, the trolls all left Thalesia a while back, and they've started to show up here in Aton. We more or less agreed that they wouldn't have done that unless they've been commanded to by someone they'd obey. Couple that fact with the shadow, and it sort of points at the troll gods. Sephrenia's not positive that they're permanently locked inside Belium, so we more or less have to accept the fact that they've somehow managed to escape."
"This isn't going to be one of the good stories, I gather," Talon said glumly.
"It is a bit gloomy, isn't it?" Tinian agreed.
Vanyan raised one hand.
"It gets worse," he told them. "We sort of agreed that all of this plotting involving ancient heroes, rabid nationalism, and the like, is somewhat beyond the capability of the troll gods. It's not likely that they'd have a very sophisticated concept of politics. So I think we'll have to consider the possibility of an alliance of some kind. Someone, either human or immortal, is taking care of the politics, and the troll gods are providing the muscle. They command the trolls, and they can raise these figures from the grave."
"They're being used?" Uloth suggested.
"So it would seem."
"It doesn't wash, Lord Vanyan," the Thalesian said bluntly.
"How so?"
"What's in it for the trolls? Why would the troll gods ally themselves with somebody else if there weren't any benefits to the trolls to come out of the arrangement? The trolls can't rule the world, because they can't come down out of the mountains."
"Why not?" Barrett asked him.
"Their fur, and those thick hides of theirs. They have to stay where it's cool. If you put a troll out in the summer sun for 2 days, he'll die. Their bodies are built to keep the heat in, not to get rid of it."
"That is a fairly serious flaw in your theory, Lord Vanyan," Oscania agreed.
"I think I might be able to suggest a solution," Stragan told them. "Our enemy, or enemies, want to rearrange the world, right?"
"Well, at least the top part of it," Tinian amended. "Nobody I know of has ever suggested turning it all the way upside down and putting the peasantry in charge."
"Maybe that comes later," Stragan smiled. "Our nameless friend out there wants to change the world, but he doesn't have quite enough power to pull it off by himself. He needs the power of the troll gods to make it work. But what could he offer the trolls in exchange for their help? What do the trolls really want?"
"Thalesia," Uloth replied moodily.
"Precisely. Wouldn't the troll gods leap at an opportunity to wipe out the Alenes and Styrix in Thalesia and return total possession of the peninsula to the trolls? If someone's come up with a way to expel the younger Styrix gods, or at least claims he has, wouldn't that be fairly enticing to the troll gods? It was the younger gods who dispossessed them in the first place, and that's why they had to go hide. This is pure speculation, of course, But let's say this friend of ours came up with a way to free the troll gods. Then he offered an alliance, promising to drive the Alenes and Styrix out of Thalesia, and possibly the north coasts of both continents as well, in exchange for the help he needs. The trolls get the north, and our friend gets the rest of the world. If I were a troll, that would sound like a very attractive bargain, wouldn't you say?
He may have hit on it, Uloth conceded.
His solution certainly answers my objection to the idea, Vivier concurred. It may not be the precise arrangement between our friend and the troll gods, but it's a clear hint that something could have been worked out. What's our course, then?
We have to break up the alliance, Sparhawk replied. That's a neat trick, when you don't know who one of the allies is, Calton told him. We do sort of know about one part of it, so we'll have to concentrate on that. Your theory narrows my options, Vanyan. I guess I will have to declare war on the trolls after all.
I don't quite understand, Oscania confessed. The gods derive their strength from their worshippers, Your Excellency, Bevier explained. The more worshippers, the stronger the god. If Sparhawk starts killing trolls, the troll gods will notice it. If he kills enough of them, they'll withdraw from the alliance. They won't have any choice if they want to survive. And we found out at Zemok that they're very interested in surviving. They went all to pieces when Sparhawk threatened to destroy Belium, and them along with it.
They became very cooperative at that point, Sparhawk said. You gentlemen have a real treat in store for you, Uloth told them. Fighting trolls is very, very exhilarating.
They set up their night's encampment that evening in a meadow, beside a turbulent mountain stream that had carved a deep gorge in the mountains. The lower walls of the gorge were tree-covered, and they angled up steeply to the sheer cliffs rising 100 or more feet to the rim of the cut. It was a good defensive position, Sparhawk noted as he surveyed the camp. Evening came early in these canyons, and the cooking fires flared yellow in the gathering dusk, their smoke drifting blue and tenuous downstream in the night breeze.
A word with you, Prince Sparhawk?
It was Zelasta, and his white styric robe gleamed in the half-light.
Of course, learned one. I'm afraid your wife doesn't like me, the magician observed. She tries to be polite, but her distaste is fairly obvious. Have I offended her in some way? I don't think so, Zelasta.
A faintly bitter smile touched the styric's lips.
It's what my people call the Alene complaint, then. I rather doubt that. I more or less raised her, and I made her understand that the common Alene prejudice was without foundation. Her attitude sort of derives from mine, and the church knights are actually quite fond of Styrix. The Pandions particularly so, since Sephrenia was our tutor. We love her very much. Yes, I've observed that, the magician smiled. We ourselves are not without our failings in that area. Our prejudice against Alenes is quite nearly as irrational as yours against us. Your wife's disapproval of me must come from something else, then. It may be something as simple as your accent, learned one. My wife's a complex person. She's very intelligent, but she does have her irrational moments. It might be best if I avoided her, then. I'll travel on horseback from now on. Our close proximity in that carriage exacerbates her dislike, I expect. I've worked with people who've disliked me in the past, and it's no great inconvenience. When I have leisure, I'll win her over.
He flashed a quick smile.
I can be very winning when I set my mind to it.
He looked on down the gorge, where the rapids swirled and foamed white in the gathering darkness.
Is there any possibility that you might be able to retrieve the Belium, Prince Sparhawk? He asked gravely. I'm afraid we're at a distinct disadvantage without it. We need something powerful enough to achieve some measure of parity with a group of gods. Are you at liberty to tell me where you were when you threw it into the sea? I might be able to aid you in its retrieval.
There weren't any restrictions placed on me about discussing it, learned one, Sparhawk replied ruefully.
There wasn't any need for that, since I haven't got the foggiest idea of where it was. Afriel chose the spot, and she very carefully arranged things so that we couldn't identify the place. You might ask her, but I'm fairly sure she won't tell you.
Zelasta smiled.
She is a bit whimsical, isn't she? He said. We all loved her in spite of that, however.
That's right. You grew up in the same village with her in Sefrinia, didn't you?
Oh, yes. I am proud to call them my friends. It was very stimulating trying to keep up with Afriel. She had a very agile mind. Did she give you any reason for her desire to keep the location a secret?
Not in so many words, but I think she felt that the jewel was far too dangerous to be loosed in the world. It's even more eternal than the gods themselves, and probably more powerful. I can't pretend to even begin to understand where it originated, but it seems to be one of those elemental spirits that are involved in the creation of the universe.
Sparhawk smiled. That gave me quite a turn when I found out about it. I was carrying something that could create whole suns, not 6 inches from my heart. I think I can understand Afriel's concern about Belian, though. She told us once that the gods can only see the future imperfectly, and she couldn't really see what might happen if Belium fell into the wrong hands. She and I took a very real chance of destroying the world to keep it out of the hands of Azash. She wanted to put it where nobody could ever use it again.
Her thinking is faulty, Prince Sparhawk.
I wouldn't tell her that if I were you. She might take it as a criticism.
Zelasta smiled.
She knows me, so she's not upset when I criticize her. If, as you say, Belium's one of those energies that's involved in the constructing of the universe, it must be allowed to continue its work. The universe will be flawed if it is not.
She said that this world won't last forever.
Sparhawk shrugged. In time it'll be destroyed, and Belium will be freed. The mind sort of shudders away from the notion, but I gather that the space of time stretching from the moment Belium was trapped on this world until the moment the world burns away when our sun explodes is no more than the blinking of an eye to the spirit which inhabits it. I sort of choke on the notions of eternity and infinity myself, Prince Sparhawk, Zelasta admitted.
I think we'll have to accept the notion that Belium's lost for good, learned one, Sparhawk told him.
We're at a disadvantage, certainly, but I don't see any help for it. We're going to have to deal with this situation ourselves, I'm afraid.
Zelasta sighed. You may be right, Prince Sparhawk, but we really need the Belium. Our success or failure may hinge on that stone. I think we should concentrate our efforts on Sefrinia. We must persuade her to intercede with Afriel. She has an enormous influence on her sister.
Yes. Sparhawk agreed. I've noticed that. What were they like as children?
Zelasta looked up into the gathering darkness.
Our village changed a great deal when Afriel was born, he reminisced. We knew at once that she was no ordinary child. The younger gods are all very fond of her. Of all of them, she is the only child, and they've spoiled her outrageously over the eons.
He smiled faintly.
She's perfected the art of being a child. All children are lovable, but Afriel is so skilled at making people love her that she can melt the hardest of hearts. The gods always get what they want, but Afriel makes us do what she wants out of love.
I've noticed that, Sparhawk said wryly.
Sefrinia was about 9 when her sister was born, and from the moment she first saw the child goddess, she committed her entire life to her service.
There was a strange note of pain in the magician's voice as he said it.
Afriel seemed to have almost no infancy, he continued. She was born with the ability to speak, or so it seemed, and she was walking in an incredibly short period of time. It was not convenient for her to go through a normal babyhood, so she simply stepped over such things as teething and learning to crawl. She wanted to be a child, not a baby. I was several years older than Sefrinia, and already deep into my studies, but I did observe them rather closely. It's not often that one has the opportunity to watch a god grow up.
Very rare, Sparhawk agreed. Zelasta smiled. Sophronia spent every moment with her sister. It was obvious from the very beginning that there was a special bond between them. It's one of Afriel's peculiarities that she adopts the subservient position of a young child. She's a goddess, and she could command, but she doesn't. She almost seems to enjoy being scolded. She's obedient when it suits her to be, but every so often she'll do something outrageously impossible, probably just to remind people who she really is. Sparhawk remembered the swarm of fairies pollinating the flowers in the palace garden in Zamora. Sophronia was a sensible child, who always acted older than her years. I suspect Afriel of preparing her sister for a lifelong task even before she herself was born. In a very real sense, Sophronia became Afriel's mother. She cared for her, fed her, bathed her, although that occasioned some truly stupendous arguments. Afriel absolutely hates to be bathed, and she really doesn't need it, since she can make dirt go away whenever she wants to. I don't know if you noticed it, but her feet always have grass stains on them, even when she's in a place where there is no grass. For some reason I can't begin to fathom, she seems to need those stains. The Styrix sighed. When Afriel was about 6 or so, Sophronia was obliged to become her mother in fact. The three of us were off in the forest, and while we were gone, a mob of drunken Aline peasants attacked our village and killed everyone there. Sparhawk drew in his breath sharply. That explains a few things, he said. Of course, it raises other things even more incomprehensible. After a tragedy like that, what could ever have persuaded Sophronia to take on the chore of training generations of Pandion knights? Afriel probably told her to. Zelasta shrugged. Don't make any mistakes, Prince Sparhawk. Afriel may pretend to be a child, but in truth she is not. She will obey when it suits her, but never forget that she is the one who makes the ultimate decisions, and she always gets what she wants. What happened after your village was destroyed? Sparhawk asked. We wandered for a time in the forest, and then another Styrix village took us in. As soon as I was sure that the girls were settled in and safe, I left to pursue my studies. I didn't see them again for many years, and when I finally met them again, Sophronia was the beautiful woman she is now. Afriel, however, was still a child, not a day older than she had been when I left them. He sighed again. The time we spent together when we were children was the happiest of my life. The memory of that time strengthens and sustains me when I am troubled. He looked up toward the sky where the first stars were beginning to come out. Please make my excuses, Prince Sparhawk. I think I'd like to be alone with my memories tonight. I will, Zelasta, Sparhawk replied, laying a friendly hand on the Styrix's shoulder. We're fond of him, Danae said. Why are you keeping your identity a secret from him, then?
I'm not sure, Father. Maybe it's just because girls need secrets.
That doesn't make sense, you know.
Yes, but I don't have to make sense. That's the nice thing about being universally adored.
Zelasta thinks we're going to need the Bellium.
Sparhawk decided to get right to the point.
No.
Afriel said it very firmly. I spent too much time and effort getting it into a safe place to turn around and drag it out every time there's a change in the weather. Zelasta always wants to unleash more power than is really necessary in situations like this. If all we are facing are the troll gods, we can manage without Bellium.
She held up one hand when he started to object. My decision, Sparhawk, she told him.
I could always spank you and make you change your mind, he threatened.
Not unless I let you, you can't.
Then she sighed.
The troll gods aren't going to be a problem for much longer.
Oh?
The trolls are doomed,
she said rather sadly.
And once they're gone, their gods will be powerless.
Why are the trolls doomed?
Because they can't change, Sparhawk. We may not always like it, but that's the way the world is. The creatures of this world must change, or die. That's what happened to the Dawnmen. The trolls supplanted them because they couldn't change. And now it's the turn of the trolls. Their nature is such that they need a great deal of room. A lone troll needs 50 or so square leagues of range, and he won't share that range with any other troll. There just isn't enough room left for them anymore. There are Alleens in the world now as well, and you're cutting down trees to build your houses and to clear fields for your crops. The trolls might have survived if they only had to live with Styrix. Styrix don't chop trees down. She smiled. It's not that we're really all that fond of trees. It's just that we don't have very good axes. When you Alleens discovered how to make steel, you doomed the trolls and their gods. That lends some weight to the notion that the troll gods may have allied themselves with someone else, Sophronia noted. If they can understand what's happening, they're probably getting desperate. Their survival depends on preserving the trolls and their range.
Sparhawk grunted. That might help to explain something that's been bothering me, he said.
Oh?
Sophronia asked him. If there's someone involved as well as the troll gods, it might account for the differences I've been feeling. I've been getting this nagging sense that things aren't quite the same as they were last time. Jarring little discrepancies, if you take my meaning. The major discrepancy lies in the fact that these elaborate schemes with people like Drychnoth and Ayachin are just too subtle for the troll gods to understand. He made a rueful face. But that immediately raises another problem. How can this other one get the cooperation of the troll gods if he can't explain what he's doing and why?
Would it offend your pride if I offered you a simpler solution?
Danae asked him. I don't think so.
The troll gods know that others are smarter than they are, and the one you call our friend has a certain hold over them. He can always cram them back into Bellium and let them spend several million years in that box on the sea bottom if they don't cooperate. Maybe he's just telling them what he wants them to do without bothering to explain it to them. The rest of the time he could just be letting them blunder around making noise. All that crashing through the bushes would certainly help conceal what he's doing, wouldn't it?
He stared at her for a long time. Then he laughed. I love you, Afriel, he said, lifting her in his arms and kissing her.
He's such a nice boy,
the little goddess beamed at her sister. 2 days later, the weather changed abruptly. Heavy clouds swept in off the Tommel Sea several hundred odd leagues to the east, and the sky turned suddenly murky and threatening. To add to the gloom, one of those breakdowns in communications, so common in all government enterprises, occurred. They reached a clan border, marked by a several hundred yard wide strip of open ground, about noon, only to find no escort awaiting them. The clan that had brought them this far could not cross that border, and, indeed, looked nervously back toward the safety of the forest.
There are bad feelings between these two clans, Sparhawk Knight, Engessa advised gravely. It is a serious breach of custom and propriety for either clan to come within 500 paces of the line between them.
Tell them to go on home, Eitan Engessa, Sparhawk told him. There are enough of us here to protect the queen, and we wouldn't want to start a clan war just for the sake of maintaining appearances. The other clan should be along soon, so there's no real danger.
Engessa looked a bit dubious, but he spoke with the leader of their escort, and the Eitans gratefully melted back into the forest.
What now? Carlton asked. How about some lunch? Sparhawk replied. I thought you'd never think of that. Have the knights and the Paloi draw up around the carriage and get some cooking fires going. I'll go tell Aelana.
He rode back to the carriage. Where's the escort? Mirtai asked brusquely. Now that she was an adult, Mirtai was even more commanding than she had been before.
I'm afraid they're late, Sparhawk told her. I thought we might as well have some lunch while we're waiting for them.
Absolutely splendid idea, Sparhawk,
Mban beamed. We thought you might approve, Your Grace. The escort should be here by the time we finish eating.
They were not, however. Sparhawk paced back and forth, chafing at the delay, and his patience finally evaporated.
That's it, he said loudly. Let's get ready to move out.
We're supposed to wait, Sparhawk,
Elana told him. Not out in the open like this, we're not. And I'm not going to sit here for 2 days waiting for some Aton clan chief to mull his way through a message.
I think we'd better do as he says, friends,
Elana told the others.
I know the signs, and my beloved's beginning to grow short-tempered.
Talon added.
You said what?
Elana asked him.
Short-tempered-er. Sparhawk's always short-tempered. It's only a little worse now. You have to know him very well to be able to tell the difference. Are you short-tempered-er right now, love?
She teased her husband. I don't think there is such a word, Elana. Let's get ready and move out. The road's well marked, so we can hardly get lost. The trees beyond the open space were dark cedars with swooping limbs that brushed the ground and concealed everything more than a few yards back into the forest. The clouds rolling in from the east grew thicker, and the light back among the trees grew dim. The air hung motionless and sultry, and the whine of mosquitoes seemed to grow louder as they rode deeper into the woods.
I love wearing armor in mosquito country, Carlton said gaily. I have this picture of hordes of the little bloodsuckers sitting around with teeny little hammers, trying to pound their beaks straight again.
They won't really try to bite you through the steel, Sir Carlton, Zelasta told him. They're attracted by smell, and I don't think any living creature finds the smell of a lean armor all that appetizing.
You're taking all the fun out of it, Zelasta.
Sorry, Sir Carlton. There was a rumble far off to the east.
The perfect end to a day gone sour, Stragan observed. A nice rousing thunderstorm with lots of lightning, hail, driving rain, and howling winds.
Then, echoing down some unseen canyon back in the forest, there came a hoarse, roaring bellow. Almost immediately, there came an answer from the opposite direction. Sir Olaf swore, biting off curses the way a dog tears at a piece of meat.
What's wrong? Sparhawk demanded.
Didn't you recognize it, Sparhawk? The Felician said. You've heard it before, back at Lake Venn.
What is it?
Khalad asked apprehensively.
It's a signal that it's time for us to fort up. Those are trolls out there.
Chapter 22.
It's not perfect, friend Sparhawk, Kring said a bit dubiously. But I don't think we've got time to look for anything better.
He's right about that, Sparhawk, Olaf agreed. Time's definitely a major concern right now.
The Poloi had ranged out into the surrounding forest in search of some defensible position. Given their nervousness about wooded terrain, Kring's horsemen had displayed a great deal of courage in the search.
Can you give me some details?
Sparhawk asked the shaved-headed Domi.
It's a blind canyon, friend Sparhawk, Kring replied,
nervously fingering the hilt of his saber.
There's a dried-up stream bed running down the center of it. From the look of it, I'd say that the stream runs full in the springtime. There seems to be a dry waterfall at the upper end. There's a cave at the foot of the dry falls that should provide some protection for the women, and it'll be a good place to defend if things get desperate.
I thought they already were, Tinian noted.
How wide is the mouth of the canyon? Sparhawk asked intently.
The canyon mouth itself is maybe 200 paces across, Kring told him.
But when you go back in a ways, it narrows down to about 20 paces. Then it widens out again into a sort of a basin where the falls are.
The bad thing about a canyon is that you're down in a hole, Carlton said.
It won't take the trolls too long to go up to the canyon rim and start throwing rocks down on our heads.
Do we have any choice? Tinian asked him.
No, but I thought I'd point it out.
There's no place else, Sparhawk asked the Domi.
A few clearings, Kring shrugged. A hill or two that I could spit over.
It looks like it's the canyon, then, Sparhawk said grimly. We'd better get there and start putting up some sort of fortifications across that narrow place.
They gathered closely around the carriage and pushed their way into the forest. The carriage jolted over the rough ground,
and on several occasions fallen logs had to be dragged out of the way. After about 500 yards, though, the ground began to slope upward, and the trees thinned out. Sparhawk pulled Farron in beside the carriage. "There's a cave ahead, Ilana," he told his wife. "Kring's men didn't have time to explore it, so we don't know how deep it is."
"What difference would that make?"
she asked him. Ilana's face was even more pale than usual. The bellowing of the trolls far back in the forest had obviously unnerved her.
"It might be very important," he replied. "When you get there, have Talon explore the place. If it goes back in far enough or branches out, you'll have a place to hide. Sifrini is going to be with you, and she'll be able to block the entrance and hide any side chamber so that the trolls can't find you if they manage to get past us.
Why don't we all just go into the cave? You and Sifrinia can use magic to block the entrance, and we can just sit there until the trolls get bored and go away."
"According to Kring, the cave's not big enough. He's got men out looking for another one, but we know this one's there. If something better turns up, we'll change the plan. But for right now, this is the best we can manage. You'll take the other ladies, Patriarch Amban and Ambassador Oscania, and go inside. Talon will go in with you, and Barrett and 8 or 10 other knights will cover the entrance to the cave. Please don't argue, Ilana. This is one of those situations where I make the decisions. You agreed to that back in Kyrellos."
"He's right, Your Majesty," Amban told her. "We need a general right now, not a queen." "Am I encumbering you, gentlemen?" she asked tartly.
"Not in the slightest, my queen," Stragan said smoothly. "Your presence will inspire us to greater heights. We'll dazzle you with our prowess and our courage."
"I'd be happy to simulate dazzlement if we could avoid this," she said in a worried voice.
"I'm afraid you'd have to convince the trolls on that score," Sparhawk told her. "And trolls are very hard to convince, particularly if they're hungry."
Although the situation was grave, Sparhawk was not quite as desperately concerned about his wife's safety as he might normally have been. Sifrinia would be there to protect her, and if things grew truly desperate, Afriel could take a hand in the matter as well. He knew that his daughter would not permit any harm to come to her mother, even if it meant revealing her identity. The canyon had its drawbacks. There was no question about that. The most obvious was the one Colton had raised. If the trolls ever reached the canyon rim above them, the situation would quickly become untenable. Colton made quite an issue of pointing that out.
"I told you so," figured prominently in his remarks. "I think you're overestimating the intelligence of trolls, Colton," Ulath disagreed. "They'll come straight at us because they'll be thinking of us as food, not as enemies. Supper is more important to them than a military victory."
"You're just loaded with cheery thoughts today, aren't you, Ulaf?" Tinian said dryly. "How many of them do you think there are?"
"It's hard to say," Ulaf shrugged. "I've heard 10 different voices so far, probably the heads of families. There's likely 100 or so of them out there at the very least."
"It could be worse," Colton said.
"Not by very much," Ulaf disagreed. 100 trolls could have given Wargan's whole army some serious problems."
Bevier, their expert on fortifications and defensive positions, had been surveying the canyon.
"There are plenty of rocks in the stream bed for breastworks," he observed, "and whole thickets of saplings for stakes. Ulaf, how long do you think we have before they attack?"
Ulaf scratched at his chin. "The fact that we're stopping gives us a bit more space," he mused. "If we were still moving, they'd attack right away. But now they'll probably take their time and gather their forces. I believe you might want to rethink your strategy, though, Bevier. Trolls aren't going to shoot arrows at us, so breastworks aren't really necessary. Actually, they'd hinder us more than they would the trolls. Our advantage lies in our horses and our lances. You really want to keep trolls at a distance, if you possibly can. The sharpened stakes would be good, though. A troll takes the easiest way to get at what he wants. Us, in this case. If we can clutter up the sides of this narrow place and funnel them through so that only a few at a time can come at us, we'll definitely improve the situation. We don't want to take on more of them at any one time than we absolutely have to. What I'd really like is a dozen or so of Keurig's crossbows.
I have one, Sir Olaf,
Khalad volunteered.
And many of the knights have longbows, Bevier added.
We slow them down with the stakes so that we can pick them off with arrows, Tinian surmised.
That's the best plan, Olaf agreed. You don't want to go hand to hand with a troll if you can possibly avoid it.
We'd better get at it then, Sparhawk told them. The work was feverish for the next hour. The narrow gap was necked down even more with boulders from the stream bed, and a forest of sharpened stakes, all slanting sharply outward, was planted to the front. There was a method to the planting of the stakes. They bristled so thickly along the sides of the gap as to be well nigh impenetrable, but the corridor leading to the basin at the head of the canyon was planted only sparsely with them, to encourage the monsters to follow that route. Kring's Paloi found a large bramble thicket, uprooted the thorn bushes, and threw them back among the thick-planted stakes at the sides to further impede progress.
"What's Khalad doing there?" Kalton asked, puffing and sweating with a large rock he carried in his arms.
"He's building something," Sparhawk replied.
"This isn't really the time for the construction of camp improvements, Sparhawk."
"He's a sensible young man. I'm sure he's usefully occupied."
At the end of the hour, they stopped to survey the fruits of their labors. The gap had been narrowed to no more than 8 feet wide, and the ground at the sides of the gap was dense with chest-high stakes, angled so that they would keep the trolls on the right path. Tinian, however, added one small embellishment. A number of his alcyones were driving pegs into the middle of the pathway, and then sharpening the protruding ends.
"Trolls don't wear shoes, do they?" he asked Olaf.
"It'd take half a cowhide to make shoes for a troll," Olaf shrugged. "And they eat cows, hide and all, so they're a little short of leather."
"Good. We want to keep them in the center of the canyon, but we don't want to make it too easy for them. Barefoot trolls aren't going to run through that stubble field. Not after the first few yards, anyway."
"I like your style, Tinian," Olaf grinned.
"Could you gentlemen stand off to one side, please?" Khalad called.
He had cut two fairly sturdy saplings off so that the stumps were about head high, and had then lashed a third across them. Then he had strung a rope across the ends of the horizontal sapling and drawn it tight to form a huge bow. The bow was fully drawn, tied off to another stump at the rear, and it was loaded with a 10-foot javelin. Sparhawk and the others moved off to the sides of the narrow cut, and Khalad released the bow by cutting the rope that held it drawn. The javelin shot forward with a sharp whistling sound and buried itself deep into a tree a good 100 yards down the canyon.
"I'm going to like that boy," Kalton smiled. "He's almost as good at this sort of thing as his father was."
"The family shows a lot of promise," Sparhawk agreed. "Let's position our archers so that they have a clear shot at that gap."
"Right,"
Kalton agreed.
"What then?"
"Then we wait."
"That's the part I hate the most. Why don't we grab something to eat? Just to pass the time, of course."
"Of course." The storm that had been building to the east all morning was closer now, the clouds purplish black and seething. There were flickers of lightning deep inside the cloud bank, and the thunder rolled from horizon to horizon, shaking the ground with every peal. They waited. The air was dead calm and sultry, and the knights were sweating uncomfortably in their armor.
"Can we think of anything else?" Tinian asked.
"I've contrived a few rudimentary catapults," Bevier replied. "They're hardly more than bent saplings, so they won't throw very big rocks, and their range is limited."
"I'll take all the help I can get when it comes to fighting trolls," Olaf told him. "Every one of them we knock down before they get to us is one less we'll have to fight."
"Dear God!" Tinian exclaimed.
"What?"
Kalton demanded with a certain alarm.
"I think I just saw one of them back at the edge of the forest." "Are they all that big?"
9 feet or so tall? Olaf asked, quite casually.
At least.
That's fairly standard for a troll. And they weigh between 35 and 50 stone.
You're not serious,
Kalton said incredulously. Wait just a bit and you'll be able to weigh one for yourself.
Olaf looked around at them.
Trolls are hard to kill, he cautioned. Their hides are very tough, and their skull bones are almost a half inch thick. They can take a lot of punishment when they're excited. If we get in close, try to maim them. You can't really count on clean kills with trolls, so every arm you chop off is one less the troll can grab you with.
Will they have weapons of any kind?
Kalton asked.
Clubs are about all. They aren't good with spears. Their arms aren't hooked on right for jabbing.
That's something, anyway.
Not very much, Tinian told him. They waited, as the thunder moved ponderously toward them. They saw several more trolls at the edge of the forest in the next 10 minutes, and the bellowing roars of those scouts were obviously summoning the rest of the pack. The only troll Sparhawk had ever seen before had been Gwerig, and Gwerig had been dwarfed and grossly deformed. He quickly began to revise his assessment of the creatures. They were, as Olaf had stated, about 9 feet tall, and they were covered with dark brown, shaggy fur. Their arms were very long, and their huge hands hung below their knees. Their faces were brutish, with heavy brow ridges, muzzle-like mouths, and protruding fangs. Their eyes were small, deep-set, and they burned with a dreadful hunger. They slouched along at the edge of the forest, not really trying to conceal themselves, and Sparhawk clearly saw that their long arms played a significant part in their locomotion, sometimes serving as an additional leg, and sometimes grasping trees to help pull themselves along. Their movements were flowing, even graceful, and bespoke an enormous agility.
"Are we more or less ready?" Olaf asked them.
"I could stand to wait a little longer," Kalton replied.
"How long?"
40 or 50 years sounds about right to me. What did you have in mind?
I've seen about 15 different individuals, the big Thalesian noted. They're coming out one by one to have a look, and that means that they're all more or less gathered just back under the trees. I thought I'd insult them for a while. When a troll gets angry, he doesn't really think. Of course, trolls don't have very much to think with in the first place. I'd like to provoke them into an ill-considered attack if possible. If I really insult them, they'll scream and howl and then come rushing out of those woods foaming at their mouths. They'll be easy targets for the bowmen at that point, and if a few of them get through, we can charge them with our horses and the lances. We should be able to kill quite a few of them before they come to their senses. I'd really like to whittle down their numbers. And enraged trolls make easy targets.
Do you think we might be able to kill enough of them to frighten the rest away?
Kalton asked.
I wouldn't count on it, but anything's possible, I suppose. I'd have sworn that you couldn't get 100 trolls to even walk in the same direction at the same time. So the situation here is completely new to me.
Let me talk with the others before we precipitate anything, Sparhawk told him.
He turned and walked back to where the knights and the Paloi waited with their horses. Vanyan stood with Stragan and Gessa and Kring.
"We are about ready to start," Sparhawk told them.
"Did you plan to invite the trolls?" Stragan asked him. "Or are we going to begin without them?"
"Olaf's going to see if he can provoke them into something rash," Sparhawk replied. "The stakes should slow them down enough so that our archers can work on them. We want to thin them out a bit. If they manage to break through, we'll charge them with lances."
He looked at Kring.
"I'm not trying to insult you, Domi, but could you hold back a bit? Olaf tells us that trolls take a lot of killing. It's a dirty business, but somebody's going to have to come along after we charge and kill the wounded."
Kring's face clearly registered his distaste.
"We'll do it, friend Sparhawk," he agreed finally. "But only out of friendship."
"I appreciate that, Kring. As soon as Olaf enrages them enough to get them moving,
Those of us at the barricade will come back and get on our horses and join the charge. Oh, one thing. Just because a troll has a broken-off lance sticking out of him doesn't mean that he's out of action. Let's stick a few more in each one of them, just to be on the safe side. I'll go advise the ladies that we're about to start, and then we'll get on with it.
I'll go with you, Banyan said,
and the two of them walked back up the canyon toward the cave mouth. Barrett and a small group of young knights stood guard at the entrance to the cave. Are they coming? The handsome young man asked nervously.
We've seen a few scouts, Sparhawk replied. We're going to try to goad them into an attack. If we have to fight them, I'd rather do it in the daylight.
And before that storm hits, Banyan added.
I don't think they'll get past us, Sparhawk told the youthful knight. But stay alert. If things start to look tight, pull back inside the cave.
Barrett nodded. Then Ilana, Talon, and Sephrenia emerged from the cave. Are they coming? Ilana asked, her voice slightly shrill.
Not yet, Sparhawk replied. It's just a question of time, though. We're going to try to goad them a bit. Ulaf thinks he might be able to enrage some of them enough so that they'll attack before the rest are ready. We'd rather not have to face them all at once if we can avoid it.
He looked at Sephrenia.
Are you up to a spell or two, Sephrenia?
That depends on the spell.
Can you block the cave mouth so that the trolls can't get at you and the others?
Probably. And if not, I can always collapse it.
I wouldn't do that except as a last resort. Wait for Barrett and his men to get inside with you, though.
Talon's fine clothes were a bit mud-smeared.
Any luck? Sparhawk asked him.
I found a place where a bear spent last winter. The boy shrugged. It involved a bit of wriggling. There are a couple other passageways I want to look at.
Pick the best one you can. If Sephrenia has to bring down the cave mouth, I'd like to have you all back where it's safe.
Talon nodded.
Be careful, Sparhawk,
Ilana said to him, embracing him fiercely.
Always, love.
Sephrenia had also embraced Banyan, her admonition echoing Ilana's.
Now go, both of you, she added.
Yes, little mother, Sparhawk and Banyan said in unison.
The two knights started back down the canyon.
You don't approve, do you, Sparhawk?
Banyan asked gravely.
It's none of my business, my friend.
I didn't ask if it was any of your business. I asked if you approved. There wasn't any other way, you know. The laws of both our cultures prohibit our marrying.
I don't think the laws apply to you two, Banyan. You both have a special friend who ignores the laws when she chooses to.
He smiled at his old friend.
Actually, I'm rather pleased about it. I got very tired of seeing the pair of you moping about the way you were.
Thanks, Sparhawk. I wanted to get that out into the open. I'll never be able to go back to Weosia, though.
I'd say that's no great a loss under the circumstances. You and Sephrenia are happy, and that's all that matters.
I'll agree there. When you get back to Kyrellos, try to put the best face on it you can, though. I'm afraid Dolmont will burst into flames when he hears about it.
He might surprise you, Banyan.
Sparhawk was a bit startled to discover that he still remembered a few words in troll. Ulaf stood in the center of their narrow gap, bellowing at the forest in that snarling tongue.
What's he saying?
Kalton asked curiously.
It wouldn't translate very well, Sparhawk replied. Trollish insults lean heavily in the direction of body functions.
Oh, sorry I asked.
You'd be a lot sorrier if I could translate, Sparhawk said,
wincing at a particularly vile imprecation Ulaf had just hurled at the trolls. The trolls, it appeared, took insults very seriously. Unlike humans, they seemed not to be able to shrug such things off as no more than a customary prelude to battle. They howled at each new sally from the big Genidian knight. A number of them appeared at the edge of the wood, foaming at the mouth and stamping in rage.
How much longer before they charge? Tinian asked his tall blonde friend. You can't always tell with trolls, Ulaf replied. I don't think they're accustomed to fighting in groups. I can't say for sure, but I think one of them will lose his temper before the others,
and he'll come rushing at us. I'm not positive if the others will follow.
He roared something else at the huge creatures at the forest's edge. One of the trolls shrieked with fury and broke into a shambling three-legged run, brandishing a huge club in his free hand. First one troll, then several others, began to run after him. Sparhawk glanced around, checking the positions of his archers. Halad, he noted, had given his crossbow to another young Pandion, and stood coolly, sighting along the shaft of the javelin resting across the center of his improvised engine. The troll in the lead was swinging wildly at the sharpened stakes with his club, but the springy saplings bent beneath his blows and then snapped back into place. The enraged troll lifted his muzzle and howled in frustration. Halad cut the rope holding his oversized bow drawn back. The limbs of the bow snapped forward with an almost musical twang, and the javelin shot forward in a long, smooth arc to sink into the troll's vast, furry chest with a meaty-sounding chunk. The troll jerked back and stood staring stupidly at the shaft protruding from his chest. He touched it with one tentative finger, as if he could not even begin to understand how it had gotten there. Then he sat down heavily, with blood pouring from his mouth. He grasped the shaft feebly with both hands and wrenched at it. A fresh gush of blood burst from his mouth, and he sighed and toppled over on one side.
"Good shot!" Kaltin called his congratulations to Sparhawk's squire, who, with the help of two other young Pandions, was already re-cocking the engine.
"Pass the word to the other archers," Halad called back. "The trolls stop when they come to those stakes. They don't seem to be able to understand them, and they make perfect targets when they're standing still like that."
"Right."
Kaltin went to the archers on one side of the canyon, and Bevier to the other, to pass the word along. The half-dozen or so trolls who had followed the first one paid no attention to his fall, and lunged on forward toward the field of sharpened stakes.
"We might have a problem, Sparhawk," Tinian said. "They're not used to fighting in groups, so they don't pay any attention to casualties. Ulaf says that they don't die of natural causes, so they don't really understand what death's all about. I don't think they'll back away just because we kill all their comrades. It's not like fighting humans, I'm afraid. They'll make one charge, and they'll keep coming until they're all dead. We may have to adjust our tactics to take that into account."
More trolls came out of the trees, and Ulaf continued to shout obscenities at them. Kaltin and Bevier returned.
"I just had a thought," Kaltin said. "Ulaf, will the females attack too?"
"Probably."
"How do you tell the females from the males?"
"Are you having urges?"
"That's disgusting. I just don't want to kill women, that's all."
"Women? These are trolls, Kaltin, not people. You can't tell a female from a male unless she's got cubs with her, or unless you get very, very close to her. And that's not a good idea. A sow will tear off your head just as quickly as a boar will."
The Genidian went back to shouting insults. More trolls joined the charge, and then, with a vast roar, the entire edge of the woods erupted with the monsters. They did not pause, but joined the loping charge.
"That's it," Ulaf said with a certain satisfaction. "The whole pack's committed now. Let's go get our horses."
They ran back to join the others, as the several Serenics managing Bevier's improvised catapults and the Pandions working Halad's engine began to launch missiles at the oncoming trolls. The archers at the canyon walls rained arrows into the shaggy ranks. Some trolls fell, riddled with arrows, but others continued the charge, ignoring the shafts sticking out of them.
"I don't think we can count on their breaking and running just because their friends have been killed," Sparhawk told Vanyan and the others as he hauled himself onto Farron's back.
"Friends?"
Stragan said mildly.
"Trolls don't have friends, Sparhawk. They aren't even particularly fond of their mates."
"What I'm getting at is the fact that this is all going to be settled in one fight," Sparhawk said to them. "There probably won't be a second charge. They'll just keep coming until they break through, or until they're all dead."
"It's better that way, friend Sparhawk.
Kring said with a wolfish grin. Protracted fights are boring, wouldn't you say?
I wouldn't say that, would you, Olaf? Tinian asked mildly.
The knights moved into formation, their lances at the ready, as the trolls continued their bellowing advance. The first half-dozen or so trolls that had been in the forefront of the charge were all down now, either dead or dying of arrow wounds, and the front ranks of the bellowing horde were faltering as sheets of arrows struck them. The trolls at the rear, however, simply ran over the top of their mortally wounded companions. Mouths agape and fangs dripping, they charged on and on. The sharpened stakes served their purpose well. The trolls, after a few futile efforts to break through the bristling forest, were forced into the narrow corridor, where they were jammed together and milled impatiently behind the brutes who were leading the charge, as Tinian's sharpened pegs protruding from the ground slowed the rushing advance of the leaders. Not even the most enraged creature in the world charges very well on sore paws. Sparhawk looked around. The knights were drawn up into a column, four abreast, and their lances were all slightly advanced. The trolls continued their limping charge up the gap until the first rank, also four abreast, reached the end of the stake-lined corridor, where it opened out into the basin.
I guess it's time, he said.
Then he raised up in his stirrups and roared,
Charge!
The tactic Sparhawk had devised for the church knights was simple. They would charge four abreast into the face of the trolls as soon as the creatures came out into the basin. They would drive their lances into the first rank of trolls, and then veer off, two by two, to the sides of the gap, so that the next rank of four could make their charge. Once they had moved out of the way, they would return to the end of the column, take up fresh lances, and proceed in an orderly fashion to the front rank again. It was, in effect, an endless charge. Sparhawk was rather proud of the concept. It probably wouldn't work against humans, but it had great potential in an engagement with trolls. Shaggy carcasses began to pile up at the head of the gap. A troll, it appeared, was not guileful enough to play dead. He would continue to attack until he died, or was so severely injured that he could not continue. After several ranks of the knights had struck the troll front, some of the brutes had as many as four broken-off lances protruding from them. Still the monsters came, clamoring over the bleeding bodies of their fellows. Sparhawk, Vanyan, Kaltan, and Tinian made their second charge. They speared fresh trolls in the raging front, snapped off their lances with well-practiced twists of their arms, and veered off to the sides.
Your plan seems to be going well, Kaltan congratulated his friend. The horses have time to rest between charges.
That was part of the idea,
Sparhawk replied, a bit smugly, as he took a fresh lance from the rack at the rear of the column. The storm was nearly on them now. The howling wind shrieked among the trees, and lightning staggered down in brilliant flashes from the purple clouds. Then, from back in the forest, there came a tremendous bellow.
What in God's name was that? Kaltan cried. Nothing can make that much noise.
Whatever it was huge, and it was coming toward them, crushing the forest as it came. The raging wind carried a foul reptilian reek as it tore at the visored faces of the armored knights.
It stinks like a charnel house, Tinian shouted over the noise of the storm and the battle.
Can you tell what it is, Vanyan? Sparhawk demanded.
No, the preceptor replied. Whatever it is, it's big, though. Bigger than anything I've ever encountered.
Then the rain struck in driving sheets, obscuring the knight's vision, and half-concealing the advancing trolls.
Keep at them, Sparhawk commanded in a great voice. Don't let up!
The methodical charges continued as the trolls doggedly pushed through the mud into the killing zone. The strategy was going well, but it had not been without casualties. Several horses were down, felled by club strokes from wounded and enraged trolls, and a few armored knights lay motionless on the rain-swept ground. Then the wind suddenly dropped, and the rain slackened as the calm at the center of the storm passed over them.
"What's that?"
Tinian shouted, pointing beyond the howling trolls.
It was a single incandescent spark, brighter than the sun, and it hung just over the edge of the forest. It began to grow ominously, swelling, surging, surrounded by a blazing halo of purplish light.
"There's something inside it," Carlton yelled.
Sparhawk strained to see, squinting in the brilliant purple light that illuminated the battleground.
"It's alive," he said tersely. "It's moving."
The ball of purple light swelled faster and faster, and blazing orange flames shot out from the edges of it. There was someone standing in the center of that fiery ball, someone robed and hooded and burning green. The figure raised one hand, opened it wide, and a searing bolt of lightning shot from that open palm. A charging Cyrenic knight and his horse were blasted into charred fragments by the bolt. And then, from behind that searing light, an enormous shape reared up out of the forest. It was impossible that anything alive could be so huge. The head left no doubt that the creature was reptilian. The huge head was earlessly sleek, scaly, and had a protruding lipless muzzle filled with row after row of back-curving teeth. It had a short neck, narrow shoulders, and tiny forepaws. The rest of the body was mercifully concealed by the trees.
"We can't fight that thing," Carlton cried.
The hooded figure within the ball of purple and orange fire raised its arm again. It seemed to clench itself, and then again the lightning shot from its open palm and stopped, exploding in midair in a dazzling shower of sparks.
"Did you do that?" Vanyan shouted at Sparhawk.
"Not me, Vanyan. I'm not that fast."
Then they heard the deep, resonant voice chanting in Styric. Sparhawk wheeled Farron to look. It was Zelasta. The silvery-haired Styric stood partway up the steep slope on the north side of the canyon, his white robe gleaming in the storm's half-light. He had both arms extended over his head, and his staff, which Sparhawk had thought to be no more than an affectation, blazed with energy. He swung the staff downward, pointing it at the hooded figure standing in its fiery nimbus. A brilliant spark shot from the tip of the staff and sizzled as it passed over the heads of the Paloi and the armored knights to explode against the ball of fire. The figure in the fire flinched, and once more lightning shot from its open palm, directed at Zelasta this time. The Styric brushed it disdainfully aside with his staff and immediately responded with another of those brilliant sparks of light, which shattered like the last on the surface of the ball of fire. Again the hooded one inside its protecting fire flinched, more violently this time. The gigantic creature behind it screamed and drew back into the darkness. The church knights, dumbfounded by the dreadful confrontation, had frozen in their tracks.
"We have our own work to attend to, gentlemen," Vanyan roared his reminder. "Charge!"
Sparhawk shook his head to clear his mind.
"Thanks, Vanyan," he said to his friend. "I got distracted there for a moment."
"Pay attention, Sparhawk,"
Vanyan said crisply, in precisely the same tone he had always used on the practice field years before, when Sparhawk and Carlton had been novices.
"Yes, my Lord Preceptor,"
Sparhawk replied automatically, in the self-same embarrassed tone he had used as a stripling. The two looked at each other, and then they both laughed.
"Just like old times," Carlton said gaily. "Well then, why don't we go troll hunting and leave the incidentals to Zelasta?"
The knights continued their endless charge, and the two magicians continued their fiery duel overhead. The trolls were no less savage now, but their numbers were diminished, and the huge pile of their dead impeded their attack. The bloody work on the ground went on and on, while the air above the battleground sizzled and crackled with awful fire.
"Is it my imagination, or is our purple friend up there getting a little pale and wan?"
Tinian suggested, as they took up fresh lances once more.
"His fire's beginning to fade just a bit," Carlton agreed, "and he's taking longer and longer to work himself up to another thunderbolt."
"Don't grow overconfident, gentlemen," Vanyan admonished them. "We still have trolls to deal with, and I assume that oversized lizard's still out there in the forest.
I was trying very hard not to think about that, Colton replied.
Then, very suddenly as it had expanded, the ball of purple-orange fire began to contract. Zelasta stepped up his attack, the fiery sparks shooting from his staff in rapid succession to burst against the outer surface of that rapidly constricting nimbus like fiery hail. Then the blazing orb vanished. A cheer went up from the Paloi, and the trolls faltered. Halad, his face strangely numb, set another javelin on his improvised engine and cut the rope to unleash his missile. The javelin sprang from the huge bow, and as it sped forward, it seemed to ignite, and it blazed with light as it arced out higher and farther than any of the young man's previous shots had done. The great lizard roared, rearing up out of the forest, its awful mouth gaping, and then the burning javelin took it full in the chest. It sank deep, and the hideous creature shrieked a great cry of agony and rage, its forepaws clutching futilely at the burning shaft. And then there was a heavy, muffled thud within the monster's body, a confined explosion that shook the very ground. The vast lizard burst open in a spray of bloody fire, and its ripped remains sank, twitching, back into the forest. A nebulous kind of wavering appeared at the edge of the trees, a wavering very much like the shimmer of heat on a hot summer day. And then they all saw something emerging from that shimmer. It was a face only, brutish, ugly, and filled with rage and frustration. The shaggy face sloped sharply back from its fang-filled muzzle, and the pig-like eyes burned in their sockets. It howled, a vast howl that tore at the very air. It howled again, and Sparhawk recoiled. The wavering apparition was bellowing in troll. Again it howled, its thunderous voice bending the trees around it like a vast wind.
"What in God's name is that?" Devier cried.
"Gorg," Ulof replied tensely. "The troll god of kill." The immortal beast howled yet again, and then it vanished. Chapter 23. All semblance of cooperation among the trolls vanished with the disappearance of Gorg. They were not, as Ulof had so frequently pointed out, creatures that normally ran in packs, and without the presence of the god to coerce them into semi-unity, they reverted to their customary antagonism toward each other. Their charge faltered as a number of very nasty fights broke out in their ranks. These fights quickly spread, and within moments there was a general brawl in progress out beyond the mouth of the canyon.
"Well?" Colton asked Ulof.
"It's over." The Genidian knight shrugged. "At least our part of it is. The riot among the trolls themselves might go on for quite a while, though."
Kring, it appeared, had reached the same conclusion, and his Paloi moved purposefully on the heaps of trollish casualties, their sabers and lances at the ready. Halad was still standing behind his roughly constructed engine, his face blank and his eyes unseeing. Then he seemed to awaken.
"What happened?"
he asked, looking around with some confusion.
"You killed that big reptile, my young friend," Tinian told him. "It was a spectacular shot."
"I did? I don't remember even shooting at it. I thought it was out of range."
Zelasta had come down from the sloping side of the canyon with a look of satisfaction on his beetle-browed face.
"I'm afraid I had to override your thoughts for a few moments there, young sir," he explained to Sparhawk's squire. "I needed your engine to deal with the thunder beast. I hope you'll forgive me, but there wasn't time to consult with you about it."
"That's quite all right, learned one. I just wish I'd been able to see the shot. What kind of beast was it?"
"Its species roamed the earth millions of years ago," the Styric replied, "before mankind or even the trolls emerged. Our opponent appears to be very gifted in resurrecting the ancient dead."
"Was that him inside that ball of fire?" Colton asked.
"I can't be positive about that, Sir Colton. It seems that we have many layers of enemies out there.
If the one in the orb wasn't our main enemy, though, he was probably very high up in the opposing councils. He was most skilled.
Let's see to the wounded, Venion said crisply.
Despite his protestations that Sparhawk was now in charge of the Pandions, the habit of command still ran deep in Vanyan's blood.
We might want to barricade that gap as well, Ulaf suggested, just to keep the surviving trolls from paying us any unannounced visits during the night.
I'll go advise the ladies that the worst of this is over, Sparhawk told them. He turned Farron and rode back to the cave. He was a bit surprised, and more than a bit exasperated, to find Elana and the rest of the party from the cavern standing out in the open.
I told you to stay in the cave, he reprimanded his wife sharply.
You didn't really expect me to do it, did you?
Yes, as a matter of fact, I did.
Life's just filled with these little disappointments, isn't it?
Her tone was challenging.
That will do, children, Sophronia said wearily. Domestic squabbles shouldn't be aired in public. Do your fighting in private.
We weren't fighting, were we, Sparhawk? Elana said.
We were just about to start.
I'm sorry, dear,
she apologized contritely.
I couldn't bear to stay inside while you were in such terrible danger.
Then she made a wry face.
Right now, I'm going to have to choke down my royal pride and eat a large dish of crow. I've wronged Zelast dreadfully. He saved the day for us, didn't he?
He certainly didn't hurt us, Talon agreed.
He was stupendous, the queen exclaimed. He's very, very skilled,
Sophronia said proudly. Perhaps unconsciously, she was holding Danae in her arms. Their centuries of sisterhood had made the small Styric woman's responses instinctive.
What was that awful face at the edge of the woods? Sir Barrett asked with a shudder.
Ulaf says it was Gworg, the troll god of Kill, Sparhawk replied. I sort of remember him from the Temple of Azash back in Zemok. I didn't really look at him closely then, though. I was a little preoccupied at the time.
He made a face.
Well, little mother, he said to Sophronia, it looks as if we might have been right. I'd say that Gwerig's spell wasn't quite as ironclad as we originally thought. The troll gods are loose. At least Gworg is.
But what baffles me is why they didn't escape earlier. If they could get out at any time, why didn't they break free when I threatened to smash the bellium in the temple?
Maybe they needed help.
She shrugged.
It's altogether possible that our enemy was able to enlist their aid by offering to help them escape their imprisonment. We'll ask Zelasta. He might know.
More of the knights had been injured during the fight with the trolls than Sparhawk had originally thought, and some 15 of their number had been killed. As evening settled into the canyon, Angessa came to Sparhawk, his eyes hard.
I'll leave now, Sparhawk Knight, he said abruptly.
Sparhawk looked at him, startled.
I must go have words with the clan of this region. Their failure to be at the boundary was inexcusable.
There was probably a reason for it, Eitan Angessa.
No reason that I'll accept. I'll be back in the morning with enough warriors to protect Elana Queen.
There are trolls out there in the forest, you know.
They will not greatly inconvenience me, Sparhawk Knight.
Just be careful, Eitan Angessa. I'm getting very tired of burying friends.
Angessa suddenly grinned at him.
That's one of the good things about fighting trolls, Sparhawk Knight. You don't have to bury dead friends. The trolls eat them.
Sparhawk shuddered. Zelasta was clearly the hero of the day. All of the Paloi, and most of the church knights, were obviously in awe of him. The vision of his explosive duel with the hooded figure in the blazing purple orb, and the spectacular demise of the vast reptile, was vividly etched on the minds of the entire party. He bore himself modestly, however, shrugging off his stunning accomplishments as if they were of no moment. He did, however, seem very pleased that Elana's animosity had dissolved, and that she was now wholeheartedly cordial toward him. His somewhat stiff manner softened. Elana had that effect on people,
and he became somehow less reserved and more human. End of side 9. To continue, turn the cassette over.